everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, about news, and about current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the origin of the public schools right after this. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think is wrong with the Ten Commandments? Well, it's obvious that something is wrong, and something is very wrong with the Ten Commandments because they have been banned from our public schools, public institutions, and our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And they teach these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national consciousness. And this is a very radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. Our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still at least one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits for their observance. Now, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call that the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, common law, natural law, karma, or something else, you know, it's like AIDS, herpes, or VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and then send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. We're reviewing the book Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, The Origin of the Public Schools, published first in 1886 by Zach Montgomery. The book was reprinted by St. Thomas Press, P.O. Box 35096, Houston, Texas 77235, first printing in 1968, second printing in 1983. Again, that's St. Thomas Press, P.O. Box 35096, Houston, Texas 77235. I don't know if you can still get it. I don't know if St. Thomas Press is still in operation or not. This is one of those old-timey books that I pulled off the shelf, and I've used it as a textbook in my law school now for more than 20 years. Dynamite little book. Puts his finger right on the pulse of the problem with education in the United States, and that's public school immorality and amorality working together has turned America into a communist state, a communist social welfare state. We practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, of which the 10th plank, free education for all children in public school, is simply one of the 10. Now, in Chapter 10, he points to San Quentin Penitentiary in California. A voice from San Quentin: California's educated convicts, all the younger criminals can read and write. Now, remember, the thesis of public education is this: that without public education, children will grow up to be dumb, which will lead them to crime, welfare, suicide, and mental illness. So public school is for the express purpose of preventing crime, welfare, suicide, and mental illness. Between 1850 and 1886, it had done none of the above. In fact, it had exacerbated all of the above. There is more crime, welfare, suicide, and mental illness in those states that had the highest literacy, that's Massachusetts and the New England states, compared with the southern states that practiced parental education. Parental, that is, the parents are supreme, the teachers are second fiddle. In New England, the teachers are supreme and the parents are second fiddle. That's the system that we have adopted. That's the system that we use in America today. So looking at it from the 1886 perspective, we continue. He says, the following is from the resident director, that is the Lieutenant Governor Johnson's biennial report showing the condition of the California State Prison, the state prisons for the 2 years ending June 30th, 1877. This report under the caption of Education says, quote, Turnkey's Table Number 7, showing the educational abilities of the inmates of the prison, gives the number who can read and write at 985. Read but not write, 24. Can neither read nor write at 309. Now, if we consider the number of Chinese and Indians in our prisons who can neither read nor write, and deduct them from the whole number so as to match our whites and Negroes against the same in other states, it will be found that our state possesses the advantage in a large degree. In fact, among the younger convicts, they can all read and write. Unquote. The Turnkey's Table Number 3 shows that the number of Chinamen in the state prison is 197. Now, if we deduct this 197 from the entire number of convicts who can neither read nor write, it leaves just 112. 112 who can neither read nor write against 985 who are literate, who can still be deducted. The Indians, whose number is not given in the Turnkey's table, but the most startling revelation contained in the above extract is found in the concluding sentence, which says, quote, in fact, among the younger convicts, they can all read and write, unquote. Now that's 1877, boys and girls, and that was the Lieutenant General, that is the Lieutenant Governor's biennial report on the prison system of California in 1877. And he said, among the younger convicts in the prisons, they can all read and write. Now, of the younger convicts, as appears from the Turnkey's Table Number 6, there are 253, but 21 year old or under, while there are 831 under 30 years old. But while our young state is making such rapid strides in the way of forcing her boys first into her anti-parental schools and then into her penitentiaries, her great exemplar, Massachusetts, it would seem, is not neglectful of her laurels. The regular Boston correspondent of the San Francisco Morning Call, under date of November 16, 1877, says, quote, the rapid progress of knowledge peculiar to the educational system of this state has led to the erection of two more state prisons, one of which is for women and was successfully opened a few days ago, the number of wicked females who knocked for admission being 44. Present indications point toward the rapid filling up of this new institution in a few months. Unquote. We are constantly told by the friends and admirers of our anti-parental educational system that it is much better and it is much more economical for the state to expend money for schools and schoolhouses than for jails and penitentiaries. Now, if we take the foregoing figures as a basis of calculation, it would be a very interesting process and would doubtless lead to most important results if some admirer of our present educational system, who is a good calculator, would make an estimate in dollars and cents of the amount of money saved to the state of California per annum by that kind of education, which is sustained at a cost of more than $2.5 million a year, and which sends to the state prison its hundreds of beardless boys, while total illiteracy, which we all lament as a great evil, sends not so much as one solitary boy to that popular institution. Now, should anybody, in making such an estimate, find the profits exceedingly small in proportion to the investment, let him not convert that fact into an argument against education itself, but only against this anti-parental system of education, the public education system. A system which, being conceived in crime, brought forth in crime, and nurtured in crime, must of necessity propagate crime. Now, hoping that someone better versed in figures than ourselves will solve for us the problem above, we shall now proceed to show how it is that our educated boys find their way into our penitentiaries. Here, we will suppose, is an honest, industrious, hard-working, laboring man who has a family consisting of himself, his wife, and a half-dozen children, half girls and half boys. To put this case in as favorable an aspect as possible, we will suppose that he is in moderately good circumstances, being out of debt and the owner of a comfortable homestead, but is compelled to rely solely on his own labor and that of his wife for means wherewith to feed and clothe his family. All of his children are of an age to attend school, and all are attending the public schools as the law directs. In the first place, heavy and frequent drafts are made on the father's scanty and hard-earned resources in order to supply these children with all of the required books and stationery that the public school requires. These six children, too, must each and all be dressed, not according to the means of their parents, but according to the rules of the school and the demands of fashion. And inasmuch as the more wealthy and aristocratic classes prescribe the law of fashion, they must dress as well as the children of the man who counts his wealth by the million. If they do not so dress, they will have to encounter not only the contemptuous sneers of fellow students and classmates, but perhaps the displeasure of teachers, if not expulsion from school. The father would reason, and perhaps remonstrate with the teacher on the subject of these rigid and extravagant rules of dress, but then he remembers that the law has said that the teacher of the public school is not the agent of the parent, nor answerable to him for his conduct toward the pupil. And he also remembers that the law makes it criminal for a parent to insult a teacher, while the teacher may insult the parent with impunity. And for these reasons, he does not care to risk an altercation with the teacher on the subject of the boy's dress. It would be too unequal a contest. So, in order to meet these growing demands for books, stationery, and clothing for their children, these poor parents are compelled to work harder, dress lighter, and feed more scantily than is compatible with either health or comfort. This father rises early in the morning. The father rises earlier in the morning than formerly. He works later at night, and he goes with worn out, ragged, or patched up clothes in order that his eldest son may get a new suit so as to make as respectable an appearance as possible with any lad at the Lincoln School. The mother, too, in worn out and tattered apparel, plies her washboard with unwonted vigor in order to get money to pay the dressmaker for fitting, cutting, and making Lizzie's nice new dress, for the teacher says that she must not come to school looking like an old washerwoman's girl. The daughter, too, is learning to play upon the piano, and of course it will not do for her to lend a helping hand towards washing either her clothes or the dishes, for the teacher says that it will spoil the shape of her fingers and impair the delicacy of her sense of touch. Thus, both father and mother work harder than slaves and dress coarser than beggars in order that their children may enjoy the great advantages of our glorious free school system of education. Please note, free school. In the meantime, these children are sitting in the same classes, studying the same books, wearing the same costly fabrics, participating in the same amusements, contracting the same habits, imbibing the same love of ease and the same aversion to manual labor and the same contempt for manual laborers as do their far more wealthier and aristocratic school fellows. Leaving out of sight the five younger children, we shall now give our undivided attention to the eldest son of this poor laborer. After years of study, he at length completes his course at the Lincoln High School, acquitting himself with great honor amidst the cordial congratulations of professors and school directors and eliciting the vociferous applause of the admiring multitude. And we may imagine that we see his poor old father crouching on the outskirts of the crowd, feasting his eyes upon an occasional glimpse of his boy, but not daring to approach him because he has no clothes fit to be seen on such an occasion. Doubtless that father is picturing to himself a brilliant future for his son. He is, perhaps, looking forward to the time when he shall be a governor, or a senator, or possibly president of the United States. And very likely, too, he fancies that in his declining years he shall be able to look to his son for that assistance and support which his own exhausted means may then refuse to afford him. But alas, how baseless are all of these castles in the air! The day after quitting school, the young man finds himself for once thrown on his own unaided resources. His father says to him, "Well, my boy, I have been a long time struggling with poverty and want in order that you might become educated. You see that both your mother and I are in rags, and that handsome suit which you now wear is yet to be paid for. You now have a fortune in your education, and hereafter you must learn to shift for yourself, and if possible lend a helping hand from time to time to the support of your younger brothers and sisters, and if possible to your mother and father." Thus situated, the young man probably for the first time in his whole life asks himself seriously the question, what business he is going to follow? A more appropriate question would be, what business can he follow? There he stands in the midst of a great bustling city, without a cent of money at his command, without friends, without occupation, and without the necessary qualifications for any earthly employment within his reach. Probably his first effort will be to find a position as a clerk in some bank or other business establishment. But he soon learns that these positions are all filled by the sons of wealthy or influential parents. Occasionally, he meets a former schoolmate, discharging the duties of some coveted place, but on inquiry he finds that he has obtained his position at the instance of a wealthy father or of an influential friend. Failing in everything else, he at length seeks for copying as a means of earning bread. He gets hold of a city directory and makes a list of the names and locations of all of the law offices in the city. He then goes from office to office in quest of the only work he really knows how to do. But everywhere he is forestalled. Everywhere he is doomed to disappointment. On every hand he meets young men and boys similarly situated and making similar fruitless efforts to raise a few dimes with which to stave off starvation. Already the boy has spent weeks in an earnest but vain attempt and an endeavor to find work as a copyist. In the meantime, he has been living partly on his old father and partly on what he could pick up at the free lunch tables. Seeing the son's extreme embarrassment, the father perhaps suggests to him that inasmuch as he has been disappointed in everything else, he had better come and help him lay down those cobblestones on Battery Street where he can at least earn enough money to buy victuals and clothes. But alas, his hands are wholly unused to toil. And what is infinitely worse, he has been, as we before said, so trained up as to despise both manual labor and manual laborers. He would be ashamed for one of his school companions to even meet him walking the street in company with his own father because of the old man's horn-like palms and his laborer's dress, so that even if he knew how to work, still, in view of the fact that it was only the other day that he finished his educational course with so much and amidst such a shower of bouquets as rained down upon him from the fair hands of San Francisco's wealth and beauty. Is it to be expected that he is now going to heave cobblestones on a public street here, under the very shadow of his alma mater, Lincoln High, to be twitted and jeered by those who envied him the literary honors with which he came loaded from the Lincoln School? No, no, a thousand times no. That is utterly impossible. Propose anything but that. Yet, says he, something must be done, and something must be done soon. I must have clothes, and I must have bread. The world owes me a living, and I intend to have it. Thus saying, he turns his back upon his humble and destitute home, and betakes himself again to preambling the streets, ready for any desperate turn in events and promises of money. Now let the reader pause here and ask himself this question. What is there to save this youth from becoming a pest to society, a disgrace to his old father and mother, and finally a convicted felon doomed to serve the state within penitentiary walls? Perhaps it will be claimed that the bare recollection of his newly acquired literary honors and the fear of losing the esteem of those who, the other day, so vociferously applauded his youthful oratory and threw at his feet such a profusion of flowers ought of itself to be sufficient to shield him from temptation's harm. But, unfortunately, those withered flowers will not serve for food, nor can he make clothes either of approving smiles or shouts of applause. But can it be possible, you say, that one so young, a child so intelligent, so well educated, has no respect for the law? Why, sir, if you talk to him about respecting the law, he will laugh you to scorn in your face. Who is it that respects the law, he will say, except just so far as the law subserves his purposes? Have we not laws against bribery, and yet do not even our lawmakers on election days send out their dirty minions with money in their pockets with such to buy their way into the very halls of legislation? Are not seats in the United States Senate sometimes bought with gold? And does not even the election of a United States president often depend more upon successful lying, frauds, and bribery than upon the people's honest votes? Then why prat to me about the sanctity of the law when the very men who make these laws trample them unceremoniously under their feet whenever it suits their purposes? But, you will say, if this youth has no regard for human law, surely he cannot be wholly indifferent to the laws of God. Be not so fast, my dear sir. Have you forgotten that the boy was educated in our public schools, where it is a criminal offense, punishable by a forfeiture of all interest in the public school monies, to even mention the subject of religion in the hearing of a pupil? And do you know that there is no such prohibition against inculcating the horrible doctrines of atheism in these very same schools? That many of our public school teachers are avowed atheists who believe neither in God nor devil, neither in hell nor heaven, and that our young hero is a firm believer in these dismal and diabolical doctrines. Very true, you say. I knew very well that no religion was allowed to be taught in the public schools, but then why did not his father and mother teach him religion at home? Well, we first answer the question by asking another, and it is this. How do you know that his parents themselves had any well-defined notions of religion, or in fact any religion at all? If they had firmly believed in the teachings even of that natural religion which an almighty hand has written in indelible characters on every human heart, they surely would never have consented to surrender to the public at large the right to select the teachers and in all essential particulars to shape the mental and the moral as well as the physical destinies of their own child, would they? But suppose that his parents were in every other particular real models of perfection. Let us suppose that both in their professions and in their practices of religion, it was to be expected that he, their son, would accept religious instruction from them, his parents. But are not these parents illiterate? And is not he well educated? And shall wisdom take lessons from ignorance? Has he not learned to despise his parents for their poverty and their simplicity? Can it be doubted that even the sacrifices which they made in his behalf, that the very patches with which they mended their old garments in order that he might be handsomely dressed, that the very toils and hardships which have wrinkled their brows, soiled their features, and imparted the bony touch to their palms, in order that he might learn to lead a life of ease and freedom from manual labor, are, on his part, requited with coldness and contempt? And after learning to despise his parents, is it at all likely that he would profit either by their religious instruction, or their praiseworthy example, or by a commandment that he had not learned that said, honor your father and mother? No. No, their religion, just like their toilsome lives and their old clothes, may be good enough for them, but not to an educated young man like himself. It is only a bundle of cumbersome and useless rubbish, and he will have none of it. Then, since our young hero has learned to respect neither the laws of man nor the laws of God, and will neither be directed by the good counsels nor influenced by the exemplary lives of his own father and mother, where, let it be asked, shall we look for the controlling power that is to shape his future destiny? Well, just follow him as he hurries along yonder busy street, and you shall see. Already he is in company with a half a dozen of his late schoolmates, each of whom has a tale of woe and disappointments to tell quite like his own. Now, for the first time since leaving school, each and all of these boys find themselves in congenial society. They feel that the world cares nothing for them, and they care nothing for the world. They all have empty stomachs and seedy clothes, and there is not enough money in the crowd to purchase even one night's lodging at the meanest lodging house in the city. So one of the party suggests that, having failed in everything else, he has an idea of making an effort to get a position as dishwasher in some hotel. Or, failing in that also, he might seek employment as stable boy to clean out the stalls of some livery stable. The majority of his companions, however, frown down the proposition with contemptuous indignation, and our hero threatens never hereafter to speak to the low-bred rascal should he ever again be guilty of advancing a proposition so far beneath the dignity of an educated gentleman. In order, however, to put at rest the question as to the feasibility of finding even that kind of employment, one little fellow, the smallest in the crowd, puts in a word to assure his companions that there is not enough in the last suggestion to be worth quarreling about. He says that he has been for the past 3 days and a good part of the nights hunting from house to house, both in public hotels and private dwellings, for any kind of light work such as boys could do. And everywhere he has found the field already occupied, most always by Chinamen. Whereupon they all agree that they could not if they would, and would not if they could, enter into successful competition with Chinamen for the honor of discharging the menial duties of either stable boys or kitchen servants. At this particular juncture, one of the parties suggests that his old widowed aunt has $500 in gold 20s buried under her barn floor, and that he knows just where to find the cash. They can get this money, and nobody but themselves need be any the wiser for it. He says she has plenty without that, and she is such a stingy old hag that it would be serving her just right for them to go and relieve her of that $500. We do not propose to follow this little band of young hoodlums further for the present, but if any friend of our present public school system can discover any motive which will deter these boys from crime and to preserve from the penitentiary any one of the hundreds upon hundreds of our city's youths whose education and situation in life differ in no essential particular from that of the boys just above described, he will, by pointing out such a motive, unquestionably confer a great and lasting benefit both on the rising generation and on society at large. From the fate of his eldest boy, of our poor laborer, we shall leave the reader to guess the doom which awaits his younger brothers and sisters. And there you have Zach Montgomery's brilliant thesis on what causes educated young boys and girls to turn to a life of crime. Today, it's not the Chinaman holds the menial jobs. It's the Hispanic. It's that wetback from across the border. And even if he could take this job, even if he could qualify for this light labor, he wouldn't. It's beneath his dignity. After all, today we all go to universities and colleges. And we must have the kinds of jobs that go with the names that have letters behind them, like DDS or MD. And now we find that our jobs are being exported overseas to India and other foreign countries. We call these exporting jobs outsourcing. Has anything changed from 1886 to 2005, boys and girls? Well, hang on, we've got to take a break here, and we'll be right back, and we'll take a look at Chapter 11, The Political State as Teacher of Morality. And we'll take a look at what kind of morality is coming out of our public schools. But first, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. And the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archive. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And finally, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. We're reviewing the books Poison Drops in the Federal Senate by Zach Montgomery. I think if you went to a used bookstore and you said, hey, I'm looking for Poison Drops in the Federal Senate by Zach Montgomery, they probably could find you a copy. Meanwhile, back on the farm, it's a dynamite little book, 132 pages, published or reprinted, I should say, by the St. Thomas Press, P.O. Box 35096. Houston, Texas, 77235. Originally printed in 1886 by Gibson Brothers Printers and Bookbinders, Washington. Well, let's take a look at morality. Now, today we know that the Bible, God, the Ten Commandments have all been banned from our public schools. It isn't something new. It was also banned back in the 1880s. Well, at least in many public schools, not all, but many. Now it's banned in all public schools. What takes the place of the Ten Commandments in public school? Well, the answer is the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. If you're happy with the public school system, morality, the United States, the economy, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the lobbying and bribes that are being paid to your representatives, the election process, I mean, if all of this is what you want, you have arrived. Nirvana is here. This is heaven. If you're disappointed with some or all of the above problems that are in our society today, then listen up. Zach Montgomery has more. The political state as a teacher of morality. Section 1702 of our California school law provides, among other things, that it shall be the duty of all teachers to endeavor to impress upon the minds of the pupils the principles of morality. Morality. But just here, the question arises, what is morality? And how is a teacher to know what it is that he or she is required to teach in order to comply with this requirement of the statute? The immortal George Washington once said, quote, "Let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion," unquote. But if morality cannot be maintained without religion, then how is it possible, we would inquire, for this public school teacher to inculcate the principles of morality without inculcating the principles of religion? But the principles of religion are understood by the Jews very differently from what they are by the Christians, and by the Roman Catholics differently from what they are by Protestants, and by Episcopalians differently from what they are by Presbyterians, and by Presbyterians differently from what they are by Unitarians, and by those who reject the authority of both the Old and New Testament differently from what they are by either Jews or Christians of any denomination whatsoever, not to mention atheists and other infidels. Then how is it possible for the state to require of the teacher that the teacher teach morals in the public schools without requiring as the basis of such teaching the inculcation of religious principles such as are necessarily antagonistic to the conscientious convictions of the parents of at least a portion of the children attending these schools? It is true we hear a great deal about the broad principles of common morality and of a common religion, but we have never yet had the good fortune to find anybody who was able to give a definition of this common morality or common religion to the perfect satisfaction of anyone, let alone everyone, except perhaps it was the self-conceited author of such a definition. A certain professor of our state normal school, to whom we not long ago addressed an open letter, which, by the way, we believe has never been answered, well, in an address of his, which was published in the May number of The Defender, of 1881, took the ground that the ethics of the Ten Commandments and of the Sermon on the Mount are as absolutely unsectarian as the law of gravitation. Now, to assume that the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount are absolutely unsectarian is to assume that people of all religious sects or denominations, as well as all non-religionists, understand them in the same sense and accept them as coming with the same authority and of having the same binding force. But is it true that people of all religious denominations, as well as non-religionists, do understand either the Ten Commandments or the Sermon on the Mount in the same sense, or as coming with the same authority, or as having the same binding force? And to that we say no, and most emphatically no. Now, waiving the differences in the various translations of the Bible of these important parts of the Scripture, we shall proceed at once to consider some of the various and conflicting beliefs which have been made to rest for their foundation either upon those Ten Commandments or upon the Sermon on the Mount. Let's take, for example, the commandment, "Remember thou keep holy the Sabbath day, and we find even Christians differing wildly as to whether under the Christian dispensation the keeping holy of the Sunday is a sufficient compliance with the requirements of that commandment. So as an illustration of this fact, we may remark that the leading printing and publishing house of Oakland, California, and in fact one of the foremost establishments of its kind here on the Pacific Coast, is owned and run by an association of Christians who would conscientiously regard it as a sin to do unnecessary work on a Saturday. And we all know that pretty much our entire Jewish population entertain a similar belief. But not only do our people differ as to the particular day which is required by the above commandment to be kept holy, but they differ also as to the proper mode of keeping it holy. Thus, the Catholic believes that unless released from the obligation by some lawful excuse such as distance, sickness, or the like, he should sanctify the Sunday in part at least by assisting at Mass, while other Christian denominations recognize no such obligation. Some Christians believe that it's sinful to engage in hunting, fishing, or almost any kind of amusement on the Sunday, while others, equally conscientious, regard these pastimes as harmless. Then again, a large number of people disbelieve both in the Old and New Testament, and consequently do not look upon the commandment to keep holy the Sabbath day as having any binding force whatsoever. We here state these different views with reference to the above quoted commandment, not for the purpose of discussing the question as to which are right and which are wrong, but for the purpose of showing that such differences do in fact exist. And in view of that fact, the fact that they do exist, we maintain that it is impossible for the public school teacher to teach said commandment according to any of the said views without violating Section 1672 of our public school law. And that law declares that no sectarian or denominational doctrine must be taught therein. Now, perhaps we shall be told that the commandments should be taught just in the words in which we find them without interpretation or comment. But let us see for a moment how this would work. Now, here's a 10-year-old boy. Let's suppose we've got a 10-year-old who has just read from the Bible the command, "Remember thou, keep holy the Sabbath day." The boy, being naturally of an inquiring mind, turns to his teacher and asks this very natural question, "What is the Sabbath day, teacher?" Now, what ought the teacher under such circumstances to say? Ought he to say, "I don't know," or "I'm not allowed to tell you," because to tell you would be sectarian teaching? To such an answer, the boy in his own mind would probably reply, "Of what earthly use is this command to keep holy the Sabbath day if I am not to know what the Sabbath day is?" And suppose that the boy, still pressing his inquiry, asks his public school teacher the further question, "In what way am I to keep the Sabbath day holy? What is it necessary to do, and what necessary to abstain from doing in order to obey this commandment?" Must the teacher again reply, "I'm not allowed to tell you"? If anything in the world is calculated to bring both the teacher and the Bible into ridicule, we think that such a teaching as this would surely accomplish that result, would it not? We do not propose in this connection to discuss the question as to the state's right to enact and enforce Sunday laws, but we may remark in passing that it appears to us as if legislation in that direction ought to be limited to the enactment of such laws as have for their object the protection of citizens in the uninterrupted discharge of what they believe to be their religious duties, and not such as may be designed to compel an observance of the Sunday in any particular manner for the spiritual welfare of those thus compelled. We think there would be but little merit in a man's attending church on a Sunday, not for the love of God, but for the love of the money which he might have to pay as a fine for his failure to attend. Persecutions against conscience may make hypocrites, but never genuine converts to the doctrines thus sought to be enforced. Now, with reference to the Sermon on the Mount, its different interpretations are no more harmonious with than those that are the commandments referred to above. Even people professing themselves Christians differ wildly as to whether that sermon was a divine or only a human utterance. Now, the Unitarians, for example, not believing in the divinity of Christ, only look upon the sermon as a human production, while other Christian denominations accept its every word as the infallible teaching of infinite wisdom. So that the public school teacher cannot undertake to tell his pupil in the public school, after reading to him that sermon, whether he is to accept it as the word of God or only as the word of a man, without again invading the realms of denominational teaching. And all will admit that there is an infinite difference between the weight to be attached to the language of an all-wise God and even the wisest utterances of a mere man when giving expression to the deductions of his own finite and feeble reason. Then again, as it is with the interpretation of the commandments, so it is with the interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount. There are many passages in that sermon which are very differently construed by people of very different religious denominations. For example, it is there said, "You have heard that it was said to them of old, you shall not forswear yourself, but you shall perform unto the Lord your oaths, but I say unto you, swear not at all." Now this passage is by many very conscientious people interpreted as prohibiting the taking of an oath as a witness or otherwise, and hence they never swear even in our courts of justice, but rather they affirm. Now again, it is said in the Sermon on the Mount, as read in the Douay Bible, "If thy right eye scandalize thee," or as the New Version has it, "cause thee to stumble, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is expedient for thee that one of thy members should perish, rather than that your whole body go into hell." Now suppose that some public school teacher, when reading or having read this passage to his pupils, should be asked this question. The student may inquire, "What is the meaning of hell?" What answer could this public school teacher give which would not be a sectarian or denominational answer in its character? And how could this public school teacher so frame a definition of the word hell as to make it acceptable both to the Universalist and the Presbyterian or the Roman Catholic? In this same sermon it is said, "When you fastest, anoint thy head and wash thy face, that you appear not to men to fast, but to your Father who is in secret, and thy Father who sees in secret will repay thee." Now, let's suppose that the public school teacher were asked by one of his pupils whether this passage was to be taken as a divine authority for the practice of fasting. How could he answer this question without again violating that section of the code which forbids all sectarian or denominational teachings in the public schools? Again, Christians of some denominations interpret the Sermon on the Mount as authorizing the absolute dissolution by divorce of the valid bonds of matrimony for certain causes, so as to allow one of the divorced parties to remarry again during the life of the other, while other Christians maintain that all such second marriages during the lives of both the divorced parties are, morally speaking, invalid and wrong and adultery. Indeed, it would require a volume to point out all of the different interpretations which have been placed upon the Ten Commandments in the Sermon on the Mount. How then is it possible to teach even these portions of the Bible in the public schools without teaching sectarian or denominational doctrine? It certainly would not be called teaching in any other educational institution in the whole wide world, except it be an American public school, to simply cause the pupil to pronounce like a trained parrot a certain form of words and at the same time refuse to tell him the meaning of these words. Our conclusions then are these, namely, first, that Washington was right when he said, let us with caution, this is George Washington speaking, he said, let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion, unquote. Second, that the state cannot teach morality without teaching religion as its foundation. And third, that the state cannot teach either morality or religion without either establishing a new religious denomination or else teaching it as it is taught by someone of the existing denominations. And fourth, that the state can neither teach religion as it is now taught by an existing denomination nor as it might be taught by a state-begotten denomination without a fatal infringement upon the doctrine of religious liberty. And that, therefore, the true and proper business of the state is not to teach, nor to pay for teaching either morality or religion, but to foster and to encourage the teaching of both by carefully and scrupulously guarding and protecting the equal rights of all of its citizens to worship God and to educate their children according to the dictates of the consciences of the parents, and not the dictates or the conscience of the public school teachers or of a secular state. And we say, let the state neither undertake to teach nor to pay for the teaching of morality or religion, because it is impossible to teach a state morality without teaching a state religion. And it is impossible to teach a state religion without the destruction of the religious liberty of all of its citizens. Now, should the state ever assume the burden of paying for religious teaching, its next step would logically be to assume the right to say what that religious teaching should be. And it is in order to make it harmonize with the principles here asserted that the seventh proposition of our platform is so framed as to allow every parent whose child is entitled to receive a secular education at public expense to select that school wherein that secular education shall be given, so that if in obedience to conscience he elect to do so, that parent may, without cost to the state, secure for such child a moral and a religious training at the same time that at the state's expense it is receiving its secular training. Now, in order to do this, we see no practical way except to pay the teacher, not according to the time he is employed in teaching, but according to his success in imparting to his pupils secular knowledge, the only kind of knowledge for which, as we believe, the state can venture to pay without ultimate danger to the principles of religious liberty. And we can see no more objection to the state's paying a religious teacher according to results for imparting secular knowledge to a child, which has to be educated at public expense, than there would be in its paying a religious stonecutter by the job for dressing a certain quantity of building stone to be used in the erection of any public building. Now, if two stonecutters are working by the piece for the government, and one of them works and curses while the other works and prays, we can see no good reason why the man who prays should not be paid as much as the man who curses for work of precisely the same quality and quantity. So likewise, if there be two teachers working by the job for the government in the business of teaching children to read, write, and cipher, and if one of them should teach Tom Paine's Age of Reasoning as a reading book, scoff at everything which Christians regard as sacred, and finally complete his work by turning over to the state a score of infidel scholars, perfect in reading, perfect in writing, and perfect in arithmetic, while the other uses the Bible as a class reader, speaks reverently of God, speaks reverently of religion, and eventually graduates from his school some 20 Christian gentlemen, perfect masters of the three R's, would there be any good reason why the first named teacher should be paid for his secular teaching and the other get nothing for his? So in the cases supposed, we would ask the state to pay nothing for inculcating the principles of Tom Paine and nothing for teaching the doctrines of the Bible. But in each case, we would have the teacher paid for teaching his pupils how to read without regard to the fact that in one case they had used Paine's Age of Reason, and in the other case the Bible as a class book. And we would do this not because we claim that there is any comparison between the writings of Tom Paine and the Bible, but because we are opposed to having the state step between the parents and the child in a matter of so much importance as that which concerns the child's education touching religious subjects. Now today, I might interject, we're talking more in terms of charter schools and school choice and vouchers. Should parents be allowed to send their children to religious schools of their choice? At state expense? Well, that's precisely what Zach Montgomery is proposing. First of all, the proposition is this, that if you've got money, you should educate your own child. After all, Ted Kennedy educates his children, doesn't he? In private school, by the way. I think that you'll play hell finding any politician of any substance in the Congress of the United States and likely in the state houses who educates his children in public school. They educate their children in the best of the Ivy League private schools that are available. At least the wealthy ones do. So Montgomery is coming up with a wild new conclusion that we're just now beginning to reinvestigate now in the 21st century, and that is, should parents choose the schools that they want to send their children to? Should Catholic parents have the right to choose to send their children to a Catholic school at public expense? Montgomery says absolutely. If the government is so intent on educating these children, then they should educate those children at the direction of the parents and not at the education of some socialist communist in the Department of Education. I know it's a wild new concept, boys and girls, but it was first proposed by Zach Montgomery back in 1886, and it is just now being reexamined in the last 5 years that I know of. Now, we'll take a look in the next lesson, in the next subject matter. I'm going to skip over here to another book written by a fellow named David Barton. It's called America to Pray or Not to Pray. Barton takes up this very same subject. And we'll take a look at teacher competency testing. We'll take a look at morality in our public schools and crime. And remember that the public school system is set up to do what? To prevent crime, to keep the students off welfare, to prevent suicide and mental illness. That's what they tell us public school does. Now, we're not spending millions of dollars on our public schools, boys and girls. We're spending $500 billion. Now, that's 500,000 million. $500 billion a year on our public school system in the United States. We now spend $7,000 per student per year to educate them. We have more crime than Zach Montgomery could ever dream of or imagine. And his statement that from 1850 to 1880, that with every increase in the expenditures on educating children in public schools came an increase in crime, violence, welfare, suicide, and mental illness. And the same thing is true today, and it's been exactly corresponding from 1850 to 2005. And if there's any exception, would you please write and let me know? And I'll publish it. So that's what we'll take up next time. More on the origin of public school when we come back. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal says time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.